It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 269 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is another doubleheader episode, as we have two interviews with great comics creators. First up is the crew behind Letter 44, a terrific sci-fi slash politics comic that is coming to an end soon, believe it or not. I talk with writer Charles Soule and artist Alberto Albuquerque about the series, and we do a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion as to how things come to be and what we can expect as the series comes to a conclusion in the next few months. Then everything wraps up with Sam Johnson returning to update us on Geek Girl. Issue number 3 has just come out, and issue number 4, which will wrap up the miniseries, will be out soon. We go in depth about that, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say, and he gives you information as to how you can access his wonderful comics. Man, there's a lot to get to this week, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast two of the folks that make Letter 44 such a wonderful comic from Oni Press. We start out with the writer, Charles Soule. How are you doing today, Charles?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the chance to talk about the book.
It's good to talk with you. And Alberto Jimenez Albuquerque, the person who does the art, which is always stunning. How are you doing today, Alberto?
Hi, Wayne. Thank you. Thank you for having me, too.
It's good to talk with you guys. Charles, we talked a little bit just before I started to record about what's going on with Letter 44. Big things are happening. Do you want to say that so that everybody can hear that?
Sure. So Alberto and I have been working on this series since, I guess, 2012, give or take. And we're finally at the point where it's wrapping up. The story that we've been telling for all these years is coming to a close. So it's really exciting times for us because so many series barely make it past 4 issues, 6 issues. And when all's said and done, we'll have gone to 35. We'll have told the story exactly the way we want it from the start. So it's amazing. It's very kind of bittersweet, you know, like to think that, I mean, I love working on this series. I'm not quite finished with it yet. Alberto's close to being finished, but there's still a little, basically there's still a little time left, but the end is very, very near for both of us. And so it's exciting to be able to feel like we've built this great thing together, but also the idea of not having it anymore is kind of sad too. So let's see what else. Well, I mean, volume 4, so the series has been collected in trades, runs in single issues every month. Issue 29 just came out, which starts this last arc I've been talking about. And then volume 4 of the collected editions just popped up on the shelves too, out of a total 6 that there will be. So this is a good time to jump on, believe it or not, because Oni also just re-released the first issue for $1, and they're about to re-release the first trade for $10. So they're really thinking now is a good time for people to jump on board. I agree. And that's kind of what's happening in the Letter 44 universe right now.
Well, it's so unusual to have a story that ends in comics. I mean, most stories go on endlessly for decades and decades, and you know, like with the X-Men, you never can quite find the end place or a place to jump on. But this is a complete story. Was it always imagined to be that way with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, Alberto, like I would say from right when you came on board, you know, you knew and I knew that this was a story that had an ending, right?
Yeah. From the beginning, as Charles said, we started working on this on 2000. Well, at least me, I came on board on 2012. I think by the summer, I started first character designs and sketches. And from the first talks with Charles, he had very clear in his mind that it was going to wrap up in around 35, 40 issues tops. And he kept his word. And the story has been always going towards something. And yeah, the end is very near now. So this is not going forever. This is going to end really soon.
So there's not going to be a Letter 45?
No, this is a series that is designed. I mean, when, you know, Alberto, you've now seen more pieces than anybody else has, except for our editors, I guess. And and this is definitely an ending.
Yeah, I am at the very end of, I mean, I've already read script for 33, issue 33. I don't know what's coming next. I mean, after the end of this issue, it's like, okay, what's going to happen now? Because I don't see anything going after that. So it's really exciting.
Wow. Yeah. See, that's very unusual, though, because, you know, like I was saying, comics tend to go on endlessly. But to have a complete story and one that's as profound as you guys have been doing, I mean, it's this interesting mix of science fiction and politics. Politics is more fantasy in my mind than science fiction, but you're mixing these two together, and it's just an amazing story. I like Alberto, I never know what you guys are going to do next. I read the thing, and I'm shocked. I mean, there have been so many times my jaw has dropped open in this story that's just been amazing to me. And right off the bat, I want to say, highly recommend, if you haven't been reading Letter 44, please do, because it is something that's unlike anything else in comics today. And I love the different and the unusual, and Letter 44 is one of those wonderful books that scratches that itch tremendously for me. So I really like what you guys are doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's funny, this book, when we're finished, it'll have been going for almost 5 years, and it has a very loyal audience like yourself, it sounds like, which is fantastic. And more people find it with every trade that comes out. And, you know, Oni's been fantastic about doing these promotions like this dollar issue and thing they're doing now. But it's not Saga. It's not Walking Dead. You know, it's still kind of an indie book. And so it's amazing because of that, that we've been able to, like I said, the idea that we're able to finish this story with a story with this scope that goes to this many places is just, you know, it feels like we're making our own sort of space-based Game of Thrones here, and it's I feel really lucky to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Alberto, why don't we start talking with you about like character designs and things like that? I want to get into how the characters came to be. But when you first got access to stuff and you started developing what the characters were going to look like, did you have people in mind? Was it based on people you know, or some like political figures, or maybe sci-fi kind of stuff? I want to also get to the sci-fi aspect of it, too. But as far as the characters go, how did you develop the look of each of the characters?
Well, Charles always provides me with some description for the characters. Mm-hmm. And after I read those and I have an idea on my mind, sometimes for real references, not all the time, though. Like for the president, we had very clear that he was an ex-boxer. So I wanted him to have this flat nose, this characteristic look, like a tough guy, but also relatable, because in the end, he's the president. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anyone in mind. And of course, like, people draw parallels with Obama and George Bush and all that stuff that was going on at the time. But obviously, I use Obama for another character afterwards, the congressman who has... Well, I don't want to make any spoilers, so I don't say too much.
Okay. Why don't you talk a little bit about the science fiction of it, aspects of it? You've got the chandelier, as it's called, and other sci-fi kinds, ships and things going on. That's quite a contrast to have to do people and then also do the tech aspects of it. How did you attack that? How did you deal with that?
Well, also talking to Charles, he wanted to be very far from what we are used to seeing on science fiction. Mm-hmm. He didn't want these aliens that we already know, like humanoids with four arms and six eyes. And so I had that in mind when I made all the designs for everything in the series, science-related.
Mm-hmm. Very good, because the aliens, I have to say, they look alien, which is a great thing to say. Most aliens look like, they always talked like in Star Trek, there was the plastic things they put on their head. But to see something that's really alien, not only in their appearance, but in the way that they interact, was really cool. I really thought that was so great.
Yeah. We wanted to give them this aura of being completely different from us, also in the way they talk, also in the way they look. Mm-hmm. So I designed the chandelier as a very intricate and complicated thing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a contrast with that, with the little builders, with the little things that we see in the very first arc. Mm-hmm. So I simplified the design in there. I think they look a little bit ominous, and we don't know what they are or how they work. Mm-hmm. So that, with the fractal notion that Charles had in mind, made us design things with some kind of repetition in them, which is the whole notion of being fractals. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's pretty exciting to get to design all those things and try to make them look different, you know, even though we all have our references. I always keep in mind 2001 Space Odyssey or Alien or all these movies that we all see and love, mm-hmm. but we don't want to copy, you know? Mm-hmm. We have that visual reference, but we get far from it and try to do our thing. And I hope we did.
Well, I think you did. I think that you've done something, and I'm a big science fiction fan. When I read the book, I see things and deal with concepts there that I have never seen before, which to me is an accomplishment. I mean, I've seen, like I said, I've been watching this stuff and reading science fiction for a long, long time. And Letter 44, and you guys, your artwork and the concepts that Charles came up with are just, it's something so different and unique, and I love stuff like that. I'm so tired of the same old stuff. That's one of the things that makes me real excited about the book, is it's different, it's unique. It's something that I have never even thought of or come across before. So I just have to congratulate you guys. I think you guys did an amazing job of putting something new and different out.
Well, that was really the idea from the start. You know, I've been reading science fiction since it was probably some of the first stuff I ever read was science fiction and with, you know, with Star Wars and all the different things that we've all been exposed to over the decades, for real. I wanted this to feel like my space opera, you know, my approach to it, and then getting to see it through Alberto's lens. The thing that's been just fantastic about it, and I know Alberto, well, it's been really fantastic because this series has gone to, like, there are truly, truly epic, gigantic concepts and scenes in this book that are really hard to draw and take Alberto a ton of time and getting all these characters. The book has a big cast. There's probably 20 or so characters who recur, and they're all asked to do very subtle, interesting things, very human things. It's not just a bunch, like, very rarely is there any punching or kicking in this book. There are action scenes, but a lot of it is just sort of very, very motivated by the situations these people are in. It's not just like, we're superheroes, so let's fight each other. Mm-hmm. There's big crowd scenes. You know, in Volume 3, we literally see World War 3 happening. And I think now that you've seen where this book goes, Alberto, you'll see, like, World War 3 was just the beginning almost. So, yeah. But through that, to his credit, I know that it's been hard, and he'll be like, man, why'd you do this to me? But then he'll do it, and he'll execute it in a beautiful way, always. Like, from the little subtle moments, I mean, one of the core relationships of the book is a mother and her daughter, Charlotte and baby Astra, who was born in space. So from the beginning, that relationship feels doomed. I mean, it's made very clear before the baby's born, when she's pregnant, that having a baby in a space environment is, like, going to be terrible for the baby, and, like, it probably is going to mean that baby has a very short life. But we also, through the course of the book, learn why she made the choice to keep that child and why the rest of the crew on the ship kind of supported her in the decision. And so you have this relationship between a mother and a very small child daughter that she expects is literally going to die at any moment. Mm-hmm. And Alberto, you know, that's not easy to do. That's not easy to write. And it's not certainly not easy to draw and have the emotion work with it. And Alberto has nailed it just as well as he's nailed things like a huge American army invading Germany, which also happens in the book. So mm-hmm. I've been very, very lucky to work with him, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, what I have to say is I just think it's amazing. Alberto's art is terrific, but you also are telling a wonderful story that goes places I never expect. You just mentioned a couple of things that, you know, the whole business with Germany, the child. There's this wonderful jaw-dropping scene where I can't spoil it, but let's just say the child does something unexpected.
And this is what Charles does all the time. He always does stuff that is unexpected. Well, and it's really great to work that way, you know, because you never know where he's taking you.
Yeah, that's such a shock. When I saw what the child was doing, my jaw hit the ground. I was like, what? And the funny thing is the mother had the same reaction. I was in the mother's place at that time going like, you know, can't believe all that stuff. So Charles, talk to me about blending these two very different worlds, you know, the sci-fi world and the political worlds. Talk to me about bringing those two together in this book, because that's not something that people tend to do a lot. They tend to either focus on one or the other, but not the two of them. There was a challenge for you to do that. I think you did it spectacularly, but why go that route? Why make those things happen?
Well, you know, when I'm not writing comics, I work as an attorney, and I've been an attorney for more than 15 years, and some of that scaled back a little bit now that the comics work has really taken off, but I still practice, and I was practicing very heavily for a while in the early part of my legal career. And so not every lawyer is like this, but as part of your law school training, you get a lot of information about the Constitution and the system of government and how it all works, which makes perfect sense. And so as part of that, I've always just really enjoyed learning about the office of president and how it has operated in different ways depending on who holds the office and how the country has reacted to its president and what the original intention was and the men who have held that office of all different backgrounds and even, you know, the women who have tried to hold that office. So it's always been really fascinating to me. Shows like The West Wing, or I've read many, many books about presidents. The President's Club I read recently. You know, I don't know. There's a lot. But I think it's just a fascinating thing. The men, the people who want that office, and then the people who hold that office are not really like us. They're sort of, you know, you kind of have to be insane in a way to want to be president with all that stress and all that pressure and all that responsibility. Like, it's almost pathological to want that office, to my mind. So either you want it because you want tremendous power over everyone in the country and the world, or you want it because you think you're the one man or woman who can actually, like, save the world, or, like, keep the world spinning or improve the world. And what kind of ego is that? It's just crazy to me. So I find presidents to be just fascinating creatures almost. They're not like us. And I thought, what better lens to tell a sci-fi story about aliens than to have a president who is alien in his own way as one of the central characters. So that was kind of where the political half came from. And then the space half, I mean, I love space stuff. I mean, it's like we talked about before. I've enjoyed reading and watching and just sort of taking in all kinds of science fiction stuff since I was very little. And so the idea that I now would get to tell my own gigantic story with, when the series is done with issue 35, you'll understand the inner lives of every character. You'll understand these backstories, why they did what they did. All these things that at the beginning of the series seem kind of opaque, even to the degree of the history of the builders and where they came from and why they're doing this. Like, it'll all be laid out. Issue 32 is set on the builders' planet. It's set like billions of years ago on the builders' planet. So it was a chance to do something that had endless scope, but also see it through the lens of something very familiar, which was the president, because we've all familiar with government stories and political stories. And I think whenever you're trying to do something that's very kind of outlandish or unfamiliar, something that readers might have a hard time connecting to, you want to give them an anchor point that they can easily understand. And so these days, it used to be you'd think about the president every week, probably, if not more. These days, we're thinking about the president every 5 seconds, it seems like. So it's certainly an entry point. The president of this series, President Blatis, is very different than our current president. In some ways, he has some similarities with our previous, you know, many previous presidents. But anyway, I kind of went on long there, but I hope that explains kind of why I made the decisions I made.
Yeah, well, the one thing that's really interesting to me, if somebody has not read Letter 44 before, this is an ideal time to read it because you start off with the inauguration of the president.
Yep.
Which we just went through. And one of the biggest surprises to me right off the bat was the actual letter that series is named after, Letter 44, which is Christie, the 44th president. It's from him. And what is said in there is just surprising. And it takes even the president, the new president, by surprise. And it's just all these wonderful little surprises and twists and turns along the way. And I don't want to spoil any of them because they're all really tremendously done and just fantastic stuff. Now, I have to ask, I had heard a long time ago when this first came off, and I don't know if it's still true or not, but this had been optioned for like a movie or a TV show?
Yes, that's right. It was optioned basically the Sci-Fi Channel for development, and that's sort of still ongoing. I mean, the wheels move really slowly, and networks sometimes will sort of gather a portfolio of shows and then kind of do development on them and see which one starts to perk and which one starts to get more momentum going. And so that's kind of where Letter 44 is right now. I'm in a spot where my profile is growing, which is nice. There's been some other deals made with some of my other properties that kind of aren't public yet, but they're all good things. And so more of those things start to hopefully happen and come together. I think the momentum towards Letter 44 may shift again. I think this story is perfect for television or even kind of a film series. I think it would be amazing for everyone to be able to see these things happening in live action. But at the same time, I think it works extraordinarily well as a comic book. Alberto and I really try to take advantage of the opportunities of things like cliffhangers at the end of the issue, page turn reveals, double page spreads, like all the tricks that you have when you're writing comics that sort of only work as comics. So I love what we've built. It would be cool if it turned into something else, but if it doesn't happen, that's totally, totally fine too.
Well, I have to say that now is the time to do like a science fiction epic like what you're doing, because, you know, they've got The Expanse on Sci-Fi and there's great special effects in there. And Alberto, I'm thinking that the stuff that you've done is a great foundation for them to do this on the television. I mean, it wouldn't take a lot for them to take what you've done and turn it into something that we could see it on the television, and a lot of people would see it like for the first time, all these things.
Yeah, I think FX's right now can do great things, and yeah, of course it wouldn't be easy, but there's a lot of talented people who can make it work and make it happen. And maybe adapted in a way so it could work in screen. But yeah, it's a lot of good stuff. And people tell you a lot, like, yeah, this is a great comic book and it reads really well as a TV show. You know, they can see images happening in their TV as they read. So mm-hmm. It would be really cool. But as Charles says, if it happens, it will be awesome. But if it doesn't, we did our job. We did what we wanted to do. And I'm pretty satisfied with that.
Very cool. You know, honestly, it's a great book to read. I love the ability you have to show emotion and to do action and stuff, both in space and on the planet. So really good stuff. I really like the way you did that.
Thank you so much. I mean, we were talking before. Yeah, Charles has this ability of surprising you every time he writes something. And he never throws you a really easy ball, you know. It's always a curved one or it's a fast one. So you have to be always on your A game. Mm-hmm. And I try to be as good as I can and always getting better. And I hope it shows that I get to reflect what goes through Charles's head with some kind of scope and fidelity.
Mm-hmm. So. Which is great. I mean, you've done a terrific job. Now, Charles, you'd mentioned a little bit about the president, and I asked Alberto if he did the designs based on real people. What about the characters themselves, the personalities, and what happens to them? Were any of the people that are on the ship and in the political realm, are they based on, we talked about the president, so we don't need to talk about him, but other people, were they based on people you know, or are they kind of from your imagination? How did they come to be?
Well, you know, I think they started as, you know, certainly the two core presidents, which are President Blades and then his predecessor, Francis Carroll, were originally designed as somewhat to be analogs of Barack Obama and G.W. Bush, but that evolved very rapidly to make them different types of characters as they kind of grew into their own lives. And that, I always knew that that was going to happen, but I wanted to give the readers, again, that hook, that entry point where you're like, oh, wow, I see how this is a reflection of our world, our universe. But it's been really fun as we go along to develop the Letter 44 universe and suggest that it's just kind of a left turn from the universe in which we live. So certain musicians who have passed away in our world are alive in the Letter 44 world, like Freddie Mercury and like Biggie and Tupac. And then we see there's a scene that Alberto drew. I think you've already drawn that scene, right, Alberto? It was in 31?
With Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah, with Hendrix. So, like, there's a lot of that. There's a beat in, I think, issue 30 where we see the Freedom Tower out the window, like in the New York City skyline. And it's one of the alternative designs that was considered for that building, so it's not the same. And there's a lot of things like that. The election cycle runs 2 years shifted from ours, so elections are in 2006, 2010, like that. Which is just fun. So along those lines, to answer the question you actually asked, the characters, they start off as kind of archetypes to be familiar, but then as you learn more about them, just like in any series, like particularly with the crew, we did every seventh issue focused on two of the astronauts on the ship and told their backstories and explained why they would take what is essentially a one-way mission into space that they never expected to return from, which is a very complex choice to make. And I wanted to kind of explore for each one of these people the different reasons they had for doing it. And so when you start making those choices, the archetypes start to live and breathe, and they're not just cardboard cutouts. Like even a guy like Willett, who just seems like this big, muscle-bound, loud, yelling mechanic type, has a lot of depth to him when you kind of see what his backstory is. And the choices he makes end up having really, really huge ramifications for the path of the entire solar system, like everyone on Earth in some way. So I guess they started off kind of like people I knew or characters that we were all sort of familiar with from other science fiction and so on. But then over time, they all start to become their own people.
Well, one of the things I really like is that you've got 35 issues worth of stuff. I probably know the answer to this already, but I got to ask. Did you have in mind all the surprises, or as you wrote them, as you wrote the series, did certain surprises present themselves that you didn't have in mind originally?
You know, it sort of depends. I mean, there are certain things that I knew for sure were going to happen. Like, there's a character named Rowan who is in the book. He's always kind of a background character. And what it has to do with is that in issue one, when we first meet the crew of the Clark, which is this ship that's been traveling out to the asteroid belt to make contact with this alien construction project, they've been traveling for 3 years. And they have their first sort of inter-system phone call. Like they basically call home to talk to the new president, who has just learned about that they exist. He had no idea they existed. So they're basically meeting him for the first time. He's meeting them for the first time. He's getting his first dossier about who they are. And it's all very kind of new for all of them. But one of the things you find out immediately is that the president on Earth, in the dossier he's got, it says there are 9 astronauts on that ship. Mm. And then when you count them up on the ship, there are only 8. Mm. So clearly something has happened over the course of the mission. Mm. And we don't find out what it is until volume 4, which is like 20 issues down the road, more than that. So it's one of these things where I always knew that that was going to be part of it. I wanted it to be a slow burn mystery and to expose the kind of the character's weaknesses in many ways, which I think it does. But there are other bits that I did find as I was going. And it's just like, there, for example, there's a bit in the issue that you're drawing now, the opening scene of the issue you're drawing now, Alberto, which was a scene, mm-hmm. it's sort of a confrontation between President Blades and his predecessor, Francis Carroll, after they've been through really a lot together. They're pretty much one of the main antagonistic relationships of the whole series. And I knew I needed to do something awesome for kind of the way that they, I don't want to say finished, but sort of one of their last big confrontations towards the end of the series. And I didn't know how it was going to go. I knew what I wanted it to feel like, but I didn't know what it was going to be. And so I kind of agonized over it for a while. And then one day I just kind of was like, oh, of course, that's what it'll be. And there you go. Did that feel satisfying to you, Alberto? You don't have to like massage my ego. If you wish that it had ended another way with like, you know, that's fine. But
No, I like how you handled that. It's pretty cool. And the like, when you learn what's going to happen with Carol in the end, it's like, it's pretty cool. I'm sad about, you know, the loss that is happening with that, but I can't talk much because there's a lot of spoilers here.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean, right, Charles? Like, yeah, that final scene in the helicopter is like mixed feelings. Like in this series right now, everything is a mixed feeling. Mm-hmm. It's great to wrap up, but it's sad to finish. And with this is the same thing. I'm really happy with what's going to happen with Carol, but I'm sad at the same time with what's happening in that same line of the plot. But I don't know, like plot-wise, as I said, you cannot spell what's coming next. Mm-hmm. And with Carol and Blades, this tug of war all the time during the whole series, it's really fun to draw. And this last scene, I had a blast. I mean, I did all the storyboards, all the layouts for it, and I was having a really good time doing that. So I hope it will read that way.
It looks awesome. I mean, so the way that the series works as far as the production of it is that, so I wrote a script, and usually the way it's worked up until these last few issues is that I would write the entire 6-issue arc of any given volume. And so I would have all of the story, all of the beats, everything would be kind of worked out perfectly on the page. And then I would send that to the editors and to Alberto. So they would be able to read, say, all of volume 2 at once, all of volume 3 at once, all of volume 4 at the same time, so that they would know everything they were building to. So if I introduce some minor character in issue 22, because they're going to be important in issue 26, they would be able to see the whole shape of everything at once. And that has actually changed for these last issues. I sent the first half of it, so issues 29 through 31, to everybody kind of like I normally would do, one big chunk of script. And then I'm saving the last 3 issues, because issue 32 was one of those flashback issues, but then issues 33 through 35 are the real end of the series. And instead of sending them all at once, I'm holding them and sending them one by one, because I want both the editor and Alberto to feel surprised and excited about it. I don't want them to know everything that's coming. I mean, I could tell them on the phone, like I could explain everything, but I don't think you guys are going to see it coming, and I really want it to just hit the way it'll hit a reader. So you can tell me if the choices I've decided to make sense. Anyway, but getting back to the production of it, so when I send in those scripts, Alberto's first thing to do is to make layouts, and they are blue pencil roughs of each page. And so all the panels are there. There are kind of sketchy, but still very, like, you can tell who it, like, very well done sketches of all the characters, the action beats, everything, so you can see everything with dialogue balloon placement and everything. Like, they're very thorough. And so if you're reading it against the script, you get the whole story right there. And I, you know, Alberto's layouts, I feel like for the past, I don't know, like 6 or 7 issues, like I've had almost no notes on anything, because it's just, I feel like we're so in sync as we come to the end that, you know, it is really a shame to get to the finish line. I think that's really been a theme through this conversation. Like, we're so connected about the way that we're both telling this story that we're like just one machine designed to finish this book as best as we can.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be something because, you know, when you get to the end of a story, you know, as storytellers, you want to see how people are going to react. And I just imagine you guys are champing at the bit, can't wait for people to get to read it and give you feedback of what they thought of the story and how it ends. Just, it's probably going to be great fun.
I think it's going to be fun. I mean, I don't know. Would you say, it all looks very, it's very exciting. I mean, there's a lot of tension in what's going on. Would you say it's going to be fun for readers, Alberto?
I think, probably people are expecting something. I don't know what, but they are. And I think they are going to love it. I don't know what's going to happen. And of course, there will be people who won't like it, like who's made an end to a series or to a comic book who everybody loves. But all in all, I don't think Charles is going to mess this up, you know? He's been doing so fine so far that it's going to end, I think, big. So.
Well, that's going to be good. 'Cause I call a well-told story fun. I don't know necessarily. I don't know if people are going to be laughing at it in that sense, but I think it's going to be a very enjoyable.
No, yeah. The people are going to enjoy it. Yeah, that's for sure. And I hope so. I mean, I will expect people to enjoy all of those who have enjoyed so far. I don't think they will stop enjoying it at the end, you know?
Well, it reminds me a little bit of Deep Space Nine. When we get to the end of Deep Space Nine, there's a very important thing happens there. And a lot of people were really upset with it. Other people were not. It was very touching to me. And, what it was is Captain Sisko basically goes to be with the prophets, which is very unusual for Star Trek officers to be involved with religious stuff like that. But that ending was really controversial to a lot of people. In fact, the actor himself went to the producer and said, "You can't do this," kind of stuff. But I like an ending like that. I love something that makes me think, that makes me talk with people about it. So I'm looking for that in the ending. I think it's going to be one of those endings that people are going to be talking about for a long time to come. I find that fun, so I think it's going to be great.
I hope so. I mean, issue 34, so the next script that Alberto has not seen yet, I think is going to be at the same time one of the hardest and one of the easiest things I've asked him to do in the series. And I've never seen another comic book like it, or like what it's going to be. Like, it's very different.
Now that you say that, I'm looking forward to drawing it, because you've never asked me anything easy to draw, so I'm going to love it.
That's true. But don't you think, Alberto, like, this is not my fault by asking you to draw different things, but I've seen your work now. You know, we've been working together for, like you said, 5 years almost, and your work has gotten, like, a lot better. Not that it was bad to start with, but, like, the fluency with which you, and the way that you handle some of these incredibly difficult things to do, it's just...
It's been a learning curve through the whole story, I think, and I hope I have gotten it better. But, I say it as a compliment to you, because you keep throwing stuff that is really hard to do. And at the same time, it's not, how do you say this in English? Gratuitous, you know? It's because. It's because the story requires it. Yeah? And I get that point. I try to make it look like it's what is needed to be drawn, you know?
What has been your favorite and your least favorite thing to draw in the series, whether it's a scene or a character or whatever?
Oh my god, that's a really hard one. Well, probably the least favorite to me would be all the military invasion. It was a hard part to draw, all the machinery and like big crowds of soldiers and stuff. I had a little bit of a problem with it. And my favorite, all the space stuff, I really love. I had a blast playing with characters in Zero G and aliens and like what's going on in space and all the dynamic with the characters and the relationship. I had a real blast doing it. Not that the part on Earth has been any more boring. I don't know. I just like space stuff is really cool.
Yeah.
Very good. Now, Charles, of course, I got to ask you at that point. You've seen a lot of reaction because you've had this book out now for several years. What reaction has surprised you, or how did people react to things that you didn't expect or that you did? What have you thought about how people who have read the story have reacted?
I can think of a few things that sort of stand out, and there's a couple things. So let's see. I was at a signing in Orlando. This is years ago, where a gentleman – this is before I even started working at Marvel. So this is when the series had just started, and a gentleman comes up to me in line, and he's like, "Man, I really like your work. I really like this Letter 44 book, and I like it because it seems like you're really trying to sort of get things right to the extent you can." And I'm like, "Yeah, you know, I've done tons of research, and I've read all these books, and I love space travel." And he's like, "Yeah, so do I. It's just great." And I'm like, "Really? What do you do?" And he's like, "Well, I work at Kennedy." And Kennedy is, of course, Kennedy Space Center, which is just, 45 minutes from Orlando. Mm-hmm. And I said, "What do you do?" And he's an engineer on the Orion spacecraft. So the next thing that's going to take us to Mars is what he works on and builds. And so I'm like, man, oh man, you know, I will buy you the fanciest dinner in Orlando if we can just sit down and I can pick your brain. And over time, that guy's name is Ed Stanton, and he becomes a character in the book. I'm drawn very differently. He's the hippie engineer who sort of started working on how the Clark spaceship was going to be built during sort of 7 years before the start of the story. But that guy, he invited me to Kennedy. He introduced me to some of his other engineering colleagues. I've now been to Johnson Space Center in Houston. I've been to literally a rocket factory in Louisiana. Like, that meeting and then the subsequent access to NASA that it's brought me have been fantastic. There's also another really, really awesome astronomer named Andy Howell, who worked at JPL in California and various other places. He's a well-known astronomer, if such a thing can be said to exist. He's not Neil deGrasse Tyson, but he certainly is prominent. And he also has been extremely helpful. And so, you know, making sure that I'm not messing up things too badly from the science perspective. And so those relationships and the fact that people are willing to talk to me about the book that way are awesome. Along a similar line, I would say just one that made me laugh was a guy reviewed online, like it was issue 24, right? So deep into the series. And he had not read any issues before that. And his review is very negative. And he's like, this doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of talking. There's a lot of people talking about stuff that I don't understand. You know, if you're going to make a comic book, everybody should just get it. And I'm like, that, you know what? You can enjoy that opinion. That makes, you know, the idea that you're going to pick up issue 24 in a heavily serialized series and get it, whatever. So that kind of made me laugh. And then the other really amazing one, maybe one of my favorite moments that I still can't almost, I mean, I can believe it because I'm very proud of what we've done. But last year, Letter 44 is one of the official selections at the Angoulême Festival de Bande Dessinée in Angoulême, France, which is it's the Oscars of comics in France for sure. And to a certain degree worldwide, just extraordinarily prestigious honor. And Alberto and I, we both got to go to France and hang out in Paris and go down there and have our book be celebrated. All this work that we'd been doing for years, it just felt spectacular. So I guess those would be kind of the three things that I would say have really been interesting to me about the reaction to the book. But by and large, people seem to love this book when they find it, and it's very gratifying.
It's great because it's not a superhero book. Although there are unusual things going on, some people get different abilities and stuff as things happen, but it's not really a punching and kicking, as you were saying, kind of comic. It's very thoughtful. And on that line, I love that. I love a book that makes me think. When I get to the end, I go, oh, I didn't expect that kind of stuff. And if you want to see a book that is just going to challenge your thinking and do it in a strong visual, Letter 44 is the one to get to. Because now, as far as we're coming to the end, you talked a little bit about it. Do you know specifically as to how things are going to end? Like, what's the current issue that's out now?
29 just hit stands, I think, last week or the week before.
Okay, so it's going to be monthly from here on out?
Yeah, monthly. So you'll have 29, 30, 31, which are in kind of the main storytelling stream, and then you have a brief detour. This will be the fifth one, but we've done these kind of flashback issues to illuminate backstory in the series or talk about the history of the astronauts. And this is the final one. It talks about where the aliens actually come from. We see their home planet, why they've been on this odyssey for so long, all of that. And then we have issues 33, 34, and 35, which will close out the main stream of the series. And then you'll see the ending that we've been building to for all this time.
Oh boy, I can't wait, because it's going to be something really special to see. I just can't wait for the surprise. And I'm sure it's all going to be just fantastic, and I'm going to be like, my jaw's going to be on the floor, the whole issue probably, as I watch it, as I get to read it. So it's a terrific book. It's something so unique and so terrific in the sense that we get to go someplace we haven't gone before. And I think Letter 44 does that so nicely. And I love that. I just adore that in a comic. So I think you guys have created something that I think will stand the test of time and will be something that will be remembered as a classic in the years to come.
I really hope so. Thank you very much for saying so.
So why don't we talk about other things you're up to? I know, Charles, you're busy, but let's start off with Alberto and say this is probably keeping you busy until it comes to a conclusion. Are there other projects that you do, or are things that you've got planned in the future besides Letter 44?
I've been working on a couple of projects parallel to Letter 44, but yeah, as you can imagine, a monthly series occupies most of my time. Mm-hmm. I was able to do a short series with writer Paul Tobin called Mystery Girl for Dark Horse. Mm-hmm. And I also was able to finish a book for the French editor Glena Comics.
Wow.
That is going to be published probably by this summer. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, I'm just focused on finishing Letter 44, giving it my all, and wrapping up things the way they deserve to be wrapped. And after that, it's the end of the tunnel. It's I can see the light. I don't know what's coming. So, yeah, I guess I will start looking for a new project right after this.
Well, I hope you get really good stuff, and we'll have to follow you and keep up with your stuff. Do you have any social media access? Do you?
Yeah.
Facebook, any of that stuff?
Yeah. You can look my name in Facebook, Alberto Jiménez Alburquerque, or you can check me on Instagram and Twitter, AJA Alburquerque, and you can see all that I'm posting there, all my updates. And I try to post regularly every week, and I post blue pencils, sketches, some commissions. Yeah, you can find me in all ways of social media.
Well, that's good. Well, we're looking forward to that. It's going to be terrific. Now, Charles, I think we say one word about you is at Marvel. You're at Marvel a lot these days. You've got several books going on at the same time. Of course, a writer is a little different than an artist. You can write a book in a lot less time than the artist takes to draw it. What projects are you working on that we should be aware of besides Letter 44?
Well, I have a series, a big, big event series happening right now for Marvel with another writer, Jeff Lemire, called Inhumans vs. X-Men, or as we call it in the office, IVX, which is this big event that's been built to for a long time. If you want to see things like Medusa fighting Emma Frost or Black Bolt punching Magneto, that is your place to go for some big kind of classic superhero, supervillain action. And I think it's really fun. People seem to really enjoy it. I had no idea if that was going to be the case. Inhumans fans and X-Men fans can be very vocal about their fandom, and you just never know. It's every story is kind of a roll of the dice in that world. But so that's going on. I'm wrapping up my run on the Inhumans, which is another long-running series for me. I've been working on those books for 3 years, so I'll be stepping away. But then the books that will continue, I've been the writer on Daredevil since November of 2015. Wow. So I'm through my first year on the book, which has been well received. I'm going to be on it for some time to come, which is great. I also do work in the Star Wars universe at Marvel. I'm writing the Poe Dameron series right now, which I've been doing for a while. I just finished issue 15 yesterday, so that's another ongoing for some time to come book, which is fantastic. I love working on Star Wars stuff. There are a couple other very big Marvel projects that have not been announced yet that I'm working hard on. This, actually, as soon as we hang up, I'm going to spend the rest of my day reading comics for research, which
is how awful.
Not a bad Saturday. So that's all keeping me extremely busy. As far as other things, I have a new Image series which just launched called Curse Words, which is sort of a modern fantasy story, very, very funny and almost aggressively irreverent. It's kind of like how Letter 44 finds all these emotional moments in a huge epic science fiction story. Curse Words is the same way and finds very human moments in a story about wizards battling in the skies over New York City. So that just started. Issue 1 just came out a few weeks ago, doing it with the artist Ryan Brown. I urge you to seek it out. Very proud of that one. Mm-hmm. And then the only other real, I mean, only other, it seems like I've got a lot going on. The other big thing that I'd like people to start thinking about is that I sold my first novel in November.
Wow.
It's a book called The Oracle Year, which is about a man who wakes up with a dream, basically a recitation of 108 events that are slated to happen over the next several years, each with kind of a date and a time. And then when those events start to come true, it's how he decides to release them to the world, what they mean, how the world is changed by the emergence of an actual prophet, and how he is changed by being that prophet. And so, again, it's one of these things with a very high concept, just like Letter 44 or Curse Words or any of my creator-owned work that I try to explore in sort of very thorough detail about what it would really be like if this thing happened. So that'll be out from HarperCollins in probably about a year, probably a little less than a year. And I'm really proud of it. And I hope people will check it out. So that's everything I've got going on right now.
Good. Well, Vermont, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that IVX number one was the top selling book the most recent month, wasn't it?
If it wasn't, it was darn close. I know that DC put out a book, Justice League versus Suicide Squad, that I think was also very well received that month. But, you know, whatever. I'm very happy that people are enjoying it. I mean, the thing is, these days, it's like, I don't want to say it's not that hard to have a high-selling number one, but between variants and kind of its marquee characters and it's marketed as the big thing, people will go for it. The harder thing is to have a high-selling number two. And then 3, 4, 5, 6. And the nice thing about IVX, and even something like Curse Words, which we just got our number on for issue 2, they're maintaining, which is phenomenal. And then even harder than that, just to circle back to the original topic of the conversation, is to be able to write a series that lasts for 5 years and goes through all the way to the end, issue 35, is almost impossible these days. There are a handful that make it past 10 of creator-owned projects. So I'm so lucky that Alberto and I have been able to take it all the way. It's just such a great thing.
Well, it's a terrific book. Like I like to say, it's just fantastic. It's great reading. It's got to be coming in. Are you going to dig one big, massive hardcover when this is all done? Maybe have it all in once. I can sit all afternoon and read this whole thing in one big hardcover. Is that going to happen, or are you going to keep the trades?
Oni is definitely doing hardcovers. Whether or not they do a 35-issue omnibus, I don't even know what that would look like. It'd be gigantic. I think that would be awesome if they did, but... Yeah. I know Alberto didn't. So they're doing a hardcover, but it's volumes 1 and 2 together, right? Like they're gonna do
so
three
far,
of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so far they were planning on doing that, like volume 1, 2, probably then 3 and 4, and then 5 and 6. The whole thing all together, yeah, that would be like a huge, huge one.
Yeah.
Pretty cool to have, probably, but Oni is pretty good at that, though. So
yeah.
They really know what they're doing.
Yeah, they could do it. I think they've done something similar for Six Gun. Mm-hmm. So maybe they will release a whole big epic volume. But also, Alberto, remind me, I think aren't they making, for the hardcovers, aren't they bigger? Like the pages are closer to, they're larger, right? They're going to be printed larger?
Oh, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, that would be really cool.
Oh, yeah.
I always like the bigger format. Well, I'm based in Spain, and I have a culture of reading also French comic books, mm-hmm. which is a different format. It's mm-hmm. bigger. So, yeah, I would love that.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to see it. Anyway, if no matter what version it comes out in, it will come out probably in hardcover first and then come out in smaller trades after that. Because that way, you know, the diehards buy all the hardcover stuff, and then the rest of us, although I'm a diehard, I want the hardcovers on these ones, but the rest of the folks get to buy the trades and keep them around and get to sit and read them. Sometimes I buy the hardcovers and the trades. That way the hardcover stays nice and pristine, and I can read the trade, and if it gets messed up somehow, I don't have to worry because I've got my hardcover in good condition.
Yeah, we love guys like you. You are fantastic.
Double dipping, yeah, I like that stuff. So when you guys are doing terrific work, wonderful work. I keep using that word terrific because that's so appropriate. But it's wonderful reading. It's something very special, and I'm looking forward to more from you guys. I'm looking forward to this conclusion. I can't wait to see what's happened. Now, Charles, what about you? I didn't get to ask you, where are you on social media so people can follow
you? Right. My main social media focus is Twitter, which is just at Charles Soule, spelled just like my name, CharlesSoule. My Instagram feed is Charles D. Soule. As a writer, not an artist, I don't have as much awesome stuff to post as Alberto does, but I try to keep up. I posted a dumb photo of myself dressed as a wizard the other day. So, like, you know, it's worth a follow. There's some fun stuff on there. And then I'm on Facebook as well, pretty easy to find. So you could follow or friend me there. Again, not as active as I am on Twitter, but sort of if you want just updates on the big stuff, I would say Facebook is probably your place. If you want my stupid stream of consciousness Twitter talk, then go to Twitter.
Very good. Well, it's wonderful stuff, you guys. I cannot wait to see this conclusion. I can't wait to see what else you guys are going to do in the future. So, man, keep up the wonderful stuff. I'd wish you more success, but I don't know how much more successful you guys can be. You're doing absolutely some of the best stuff that's out there today. So, you know, both you guys, keep it up. And, man, we'll just keep reading and buying your stuff because we want to read the good stuff.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Yep. Have a good one.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always great to welcome back to the podcast Sam Johnson, the creator of Geek Girl, among other good things. And issue number 3 has just come out of Geek Girl. And how are you doing today, Sam?
I'm good, thank you, Wayne. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. So issue 3, I remember for a long time we were sitting waiting for issue 1 to come out. Now that issue 1 has come out, 2 and 3 have come out in rapid succession, which is great. It's great to be able to read the stuff we'll be waiting for a while. Has your work pattern been working pretty good? Have you got it all down to a science now?
Well, I mean, the thing with it was I wanted to have all 4 issues of the miniseries in the can before we released issue 1. So it's, you know, it's been done for a while and coming out monthly. So yeah, like issue 3 is out now, which is a jump on issue and has a 2-page recap of 1 and 2, and then issue 4 will be out on March the 1st.
Wow, okay, so that'll be good. And that'll wrap up the miniseries as far as that goes.
It certainly will, yeah.
So, wow, okay. I was reading some reviews that the books have been getting, and one of the things they've been talking about that I really like is the way that Ruby, the main character, has been growing. But before we get to that, why don't you give a quick overview as to what this is all about?
Okay, so for those not familiar with Geek Girl is Ruby Kay. She's a hot college chick, used to getting what she wants. In a drunken state, she overhears the resident college brainiac, Trevor Goldstein, talking about these super tech glasses he's invented. And though her friend Stacy is somewhat incredulous, she goes along with Ruby when she decides she wants the glasses and gets Trevor and her friend Jeff drunk and wins them off from a game of strip poker. Now, she's done this without actually thinking what she's going to do beyond that point. And though they give her super flight and super strength, there's a glitch in them that's also messing with her and affecting her brain. The initial impact of this is making her super klutzy, which causes her to knock drinks over her friends, which alienates the more bitchy element of her clique, and the majority, in fact. The only one that's kind of got her back with all this is Summer, whose dad's a big comic geek, so she gets the whole superhero thing, and Summer's actually pushing Ruby to use them in the heroic manner which we're accustomed to. And yeah, so the kickoff was Ruby's flying around the city looking for crime. This is what you do. She's not getting anywhere. Am I doing this right? And then Neon Girl, the big shot superheroine of where they live, Maine, gets blasted through a billboard by this mysterious new villain called Lightning Storm, gets hospitalized and charges Ruby with taking Lightning Storm down. So that was, yeah, that's the setup from issue 1, basically.
Now, of course, we've got 2 issues beyond that. And I was mentioning to you as we were getting started recording, there's an interesting balance between like everyday life things and comic book things in the interview. So I'm just kind of talk about that. Was that something you really intended to do? Because it makes it understandable and enjoyable on multiple levels.
Yeah, it was something I wanted, and I'm glad that it's coming over, because as I've just discussed the character of Ruby, as she starts off, she's not the most endearing character, but when the effects of the glasses kick in and the effect that they have on her clique, we see her going in a new and hopefully heroic direction. And with issue 2, we did a real a character issue with her and Summer. Their intention was to just go to a nightclub and have some downtime, and we kind of got inside Ruby's head a little bit there, and she kind of developed and kind of started to see things differently. And yeah, what in the reviews, as you say, I mean, I've seen reviews where people have said things like, you know, it sounds like real people talking, which is great. So yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Ruby is this balance of the superheroics, but which she's, you know, fallen into, and it's to the detriment of her social life. So the impact that it has on her personally, and we're getting to know her as a character, as a person rather, and where things are going to go with, you know, she's been tasked with taking down this Lightning Storm. By the time we get to that in issue 4, where she goes up against Lightning Storm, hopefully, you know, people will have really sort of grown to like her and be rooting for her and you know, feel it when she is in this this fight, which is a very daunting prospect for her, because as I say, Lightning Storm has taken out Neon Girl, who's a big, you know, the kind of Captain Marvel of our universe, and someone that's much bigger and better at superheroing than Ruby.
And of course, as I was mentioning before, about that, there's a lot of reviewers who are picking up on the fact that she's growing and changing as a character. You talk about the fact that she's somebody that is not very likable at the beginning, but by the 4th issue, even in the 3rd issue, which I had a chance to read, there are things about her that she's standing up for herself, and she's kind of doing the kinds of things that probably comics readers would like to see her do.
Yeah. I mean, before, you know, she landed these glasses, she had a, you know, fairly privileged, easy lifestyle and wasn't used to sort of doing things to help other people. And now she's found that she's got the ability to do that. She's actually kind of liking it. And she makes a new friend in issue three in Mariella, who's a waitress that needs her help. And, you know, Mariella is completely alien to the whole click. She just, you know, thinks of them as a bunch of bitches. What are you even doing with them? So she's got, yeah, she is. She's certainly evolving, and I'm very pleased that it's coming across the way I intended it to.
Well, what the cover of issue three is kind of funny. She's actually taking a selfie with a bad guy that she's taking down, which I thought was great, because that's, you're starting to feel that she's getting more comfortable in what she's doing, and that's a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that was the cover artist, William Kaledger. That was his idea on that. And it was, yeah, she gets into a fight early in the issue with a couple of D-list, D-list villains called A-Game, Monsieur A and A-Juan. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the cover then shows her having knocked out A-Juan, taking a selfie with her arm around him while he's dazed and confused. Mm-hmm. So it taps into, you know, the sort of real world that Ruby lives as a college, you know, as a young college student.
Now, I've got to talk about the glasses a little bit, because one of the things that we discover in issue two, it's what I like to call the Clark Kent effect. You can't, yeah. When she's got the glasses on, people honestly don't seem to recognize that she's Ruby, but they look at her as Geek Girl. But when they're off, they see only Ruby and not Geek Girl. They can't make a difference. They can't see the same person in both things. Of course, that Clark Kent would stand up for that and say that's so true. Is that part of what the glasses do? Is that kind of a fact?
No, that's not it at all, Wayne. Okay. That's absolutely not what's going for. I mean, the thing is, there's the secret identity question comes up in issue four, because she's doing all this without, you know, having really thought it through. And it's not the case that when people see her in the glasses, they think this is Geek Girl, and when they see her without, that it's Ruby, and they're not making the connection. The only reason she's not known as Geek Girl is because so far there hasn't been any news footage of her. But no, I mean, like Karin, who's her college nemesis, you know, sees her in the glasses and you know, starts messing with the glasses in issue two. And no, absolutely, there is no question that this is the same person. But the thing is, how she comes across in the glasses is different because of the way they're affecting her brain and personality. Okay. So issue two is a big thing about how, like, you know, she feels like she's not attractive in them, and she gets this idea in her head that they're making her, you know, kind of they're affecting her in that way and making her dorky, whereas Summer is like, that's just crazy talk. It's, you know, it's you, because you're not owning these glasses. So her body language will come across differently when she's got, or at least before we get to issue three, it was doing, because, you know, she was uncomfortable wearing them, whereas in her usual, you know, look, she's, you know, the girl that everyone likes.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about the bartender seemed to be a little, he seemed to not be able to tell. He didn't think it was the same person. When she took the glasses off, he saw her as a different person.
Yeah, but that's more to do with, you know, she's in a nightclub. He's just, you know, flirting with everyone, and he noticed a hot chick, and then Ruby comes up looking now kind of dorky, and he doesn't instantly pick up that it's her. It's not like a power of the glasses. That's a lot to do with the context of that conversation.
I guess my it's interesting how Clark Kent gets away with that, kind of ran into that, and I was thinking, maybe it's a Clark Kent effect. That's good.
No, I mean, that's something, you know, I wanted to do from the get-go, is that there is no, because, I mean, you know, hello, oh, where did Superman go? What, now he's put his glasses on. To me, I've never bought it. So, and the thing is, when things become what they become in issue four, when, you know, Geek Girl gets involved in this high profile confrontation with Lightning Storm, and the media will be on this, and there will be no secret identity then.
Because even now, some people call her Geek Girl when she has the glasses on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't come up with that name. That was a name that Summer sort of jokingly came up with because of the way that her friends reacted with how she was acting when she first pitched up with the glasses on. So Ruby's never actually agreed to the name Geek Girl, but it's got picked up and stuck.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to me. In issue 3, of course, you've got the villain that we have discussed before, and we finally get to meet this villain called Mr. Mashup.
Yeah.
And he does some really crazy stuff in there that I didn't realize was going to happen. And when I saw it, do you want to talk a little bit about the character? Because I'm a little flummoxed. He's able to do some really amazing things.
Well, Mr. Mashup is the bastard love child of an alien goddess and a demon, and he has the ability, he houses within himself this vessel that he can tap into people's minds and transform this vessel into basically a clone of whoever they most hate. This vessel then crawls out of his mouth. His skin is all stretched and wrinkled from this, so he kind of sheds his skin, but his consciousness transfers into this vessel, and then what he's been doing is using this to torment people, because he basically alienate his entire world for his then lover Delphi, and then because he lived in this dimension that's basically a hellhole, and Delphi is a dimension hopper, and she hadn't experienced Earth. She was kind of more familiar with the darker places. And when they both went to Earth, she found, you know, the grass being greener. So he kind of ostracized himself from his family to be with her, and then she dumped him because she preferred Earth guys. So he's now been left alone, and he's got kind of twisted.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one panel, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's where she's kind of, the blonde girl is pestering Ruby and kind of tries to knock her glasses off. And when Ruby retaliates, when she hits her, some really nasty stuff happens. I was quite surprised by it. Like part of her face actually falls off, and I don't give away too much, but I literally sat there and my mouth dropped off. And I said, what is going on with that? So, and then we come to the whole confrontation with Mr. Mashup starts to happen at that point. He looks a little bit like Death in the sense that he carries a scythe and he's got a big black hat on and stuff. So I'm kind of fascinated by him, that he's something very different. And, boy, he can really get, once he gets your attention, you know, you're coming to his focus, you're in trouble, because he can really go after you and do some nasty stuff.
Yes, he can. He's a very damaged individual, and he's actually appeared as well in my other comic that's in the works, Carver Cini Voodoo Junkie Hit Woman. There's a free digital comic of Carver's Carver Cini Dark New Year, and he's in that as well. So you can get that at Drive Through Comics or at issue ISSUU, and that will give you more insight into him and what he's about and where he comes from. And I'm not done with him either.
I kind of wonder, because he's quite the nasty, and he's pretty original in that way too. Because, you know, I've been reading comics for decades, literally, and to see that, to get something that surprises me is always a wonderful thing. So I was nicely surprised by all that. I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with him is he's not like Delphi Matrix, his ex, when they get into this situation that Ruby gets embroiled in. She, you know, says he's not a bad guy, really. And the thing is, where he lives, or where he's from, rather, the morality is different. Mm-hmm. And it's a much darker place. So he's not a sort of all-out villain, but he's kind of been broken by, you know, basically abandoning everything for this girl and then being dropped for a better offer. So it's kind of messed him up.
Now, okay, I don't want to spoil anything, but we get to the place where there's kind of a resolution to that. And let's just say that they go away in such a manner that they could be back. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there will be a second Geek Girl series, and I'm not promising that's where Mr. Mashup would appear again, but I'm definitely not done with Mr. Mashup.
Good. Well, he's something of a villain that's quite unique. So I like that quite a bit. I want to also say, too, that the art continues to be really strong and really, you know, easy to get into and understandable. You know, pretty dynamic most of the time, too, which I really like.
Yeah. I mean, Carlos Grander has delivered on all fronts, and it's, you know, it's only, as I say, we, part of the reason we made issue three, the jump, and it's like a lower, like the digital edition's like $1.99 to encourage people to check it out if they haven't been on one and two. Part of the reason we made that the jump on issue is because this is where Ruby really starts to become a superhero. So we've got, you know, there's plenty of action going on. I think she's involved in three separate fights in that. And these fights are running on in some cases on a psychological level as well as physically.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty good. I like that real. But I want to talk about one part that was in issue two, where she kind of gets confronted by someone that she knows who's a lesbian.
Yeah.
And something kind of interesting happens, and it bothers Ruby on some levels. The lesbian lady kind of kisses her, and it becomes well known. Of course, teenage things, these things get around quite good. The two of them kiss, and so now the rumor is that she's a lesbian as well, and of course that's bothering Ruby. And I'm just kind of curious, because once that starts out in a group of teenagers, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, they didn't actually kiss. Nina Dante got the hearts for Ruby and tried to kiss her. And Ruby was kind of at this place where she was questioning her attractiveness. So she initially welcomed the attention, but then, you know, she's completely straight, and also Nina Dante's a Fruit Loop. But what happened with this was this got filmed by Karin. Again, Karin, the Ruby's college nemesis, her boyfriend, I believe, filmed it and stuck it on YouTube. And Karin torments Ruby with this, saying that it was originally called Girl on Girl, but there were so many things called that she decided to rename it on Dyke. But the thing is, Ruby's dealing with, you know, all this. It's because all of this is completely changing. You know, she was this popular chick and you know that you knew exactly what she was about, and everything's changing about the perception of her, which is, you know, Ruby, you know, she's refers to it as, like, in issue two, when she sort of gets her groove back, I'm Ruby K, god damn it, like, you know, my name means something. And then Karin is like, well, yeah, but it's kind of better when it wasn't, then followed by Ruby K, aka Geek Girl. So the whole thing with this is, you know, it's you know, going back to the Clark Kent thing, it's a complete flip on that, because you know, ordinarily it's the I mean, this is the, you know, the crux of the whole thing is, ordinarily in superhero lore you get, you know, the nerdy kid that becomes this cool superhero, and in this way it's the other way around, because Ruby is this cool kid and then she's rendered uncool as a superhero, at least in the eyes of, you know, her clique.
But this, honestly, it feels like a coming-of-age kind of story to me. You know, one of the things I always enjoy is when people become an adult, you know. And what's happening with Ruby is she's honestly becoming her own person rather than being a part of a group. And it's kind of fun to watch. You know, I have to say I like the character in the sense that, you know, she's got quite the opportunity in front of her, and she's actually taking advantage of it. And to see her actually stop from being, because we all do this. We're part of a group when we're growing up or in high school, whether it's the nerds or whatever. But at some point, we kind of move out of that into the real world. And that's what I kind of feel like being a superhero is doing for her. It's moving Ruby out of, like, say, the high school existence into reality, more or less.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's, you know, things, you know, get real. And, because, you know, she's put herself in a life-threatening situation, and you know, this is kind of, you know, a tell about the strength of her character, what she does with this. And in the meantime, we've actually got Trevor and his buddy Jeff Now they've sobered up. Trevor's not so crazy about how easily he gave away these glasses. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see that them reemerging in issue 4 in an attempt to get them back. And that will be another kind of defining thing of how that goes down in terms of Ruby's character.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, issue number 4, you talked about a couple things that's coming in. And clearly Lightning Storm, from the end of issue 3, we get an idea that Lightning Storm's on the way back. And you've got the glasses creators coming back. And then Geek Girl has to have like an ultimate confrontation between all these things.
Yeah.
Anything else in issue 4 that we should be looking forward to that you can talk about?
Yeah, I mean, for those that have read issue 1 where we saw Neon Girl and also the jock superhero Pitbull, they're both going to be back for the big climax, somewhat worse for wear after their confrontation with Lightning Storm issue 1. But it's going to be an exercise issue because I wanted to give the whole you know climactic thing the breathing space it needed to be done just as I want it. And Summer also will have an integral to thing to part to play in this, but it's going to be a real thing, the biggest thing that Ruby has ever done, stepping up to take on this super villain who certainly at the time of issue 1 would have seemed completely out of her league.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Now, you mentioned the date. What's the date that issue number 4 is going to come out?
March 1st.
March 1st. So it's not far away. And yeah. The way we get it is to go through, talk about how we're going to get issue 4 as well as the other issues.
Well, the best place to go to is the website, geekgirlcomics.com, and that will link you to getting it either in digital or print. And there's various variant editions as well. We've got a cool cover on issue 1 done by John Royal, who's the artist on Danger Girl. And Carl, the cover for 4, the main cover for 4 is by Carlos, which it's excellent. But there's also another variant by that by William Kaledger, who did the cover for issue 3. And there's going to be a limited variant from Carlos. So yeah, you can get all. That's all you need to do is go to geekgirlcomics.com. And it'll link you to wherever you need to go to get the books.
Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, and now you've already talked that you've got a second miniseries in the works, or in your mind at least. How's that going to go? Is there going to be like, how long of a period do you think it's going to be between issue 4 and when we get to see the second miniseries?
It's going to be a while. The script for the first issue is done. Carlos is about to do the first cover. But it's going to be a while, mainly for just the finances of it. You know, you have to, if you're paying for, you know, some of the way we did the 4-issue miniseries, we did some of it back end, and some of it paid, you know, sort of per page, and it's not a cheap thing to do. So. Yeah, and I mean, also, it's open whether this becomes ongoing or a second mini-series, which, if it is a second mini-series, could then potentially be further mini-series following. And, you know, as it stands, I'd love Carlos to be on board for it as well, but you know, obviously he's got other comics work as well. So it's going to be a while, but what I'm going to be doing is... at my blog, which you can get at easily if you Google Sam Johnson comics, there's going to be like a regular feature there with updates and work in progress and saying, you know, what's going on and what to look forward to. And obviously, as we get closer to getting any kind of date for it, it'll be up there, as well as the Geek Girl Facebook group. There's always previews of stuff going up there.
Mm-hmm. I noticed somebody did an image of Ruby as Geek Girl as if she were in a video game.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a sort of cool fan thing that a guy I know on Facebook did. It's not for any sort of, you know, commercial purposes. But, yeah, you get the odd sort of fan art on there. And it's a good size group now. It's 18,000 in it.
Wow.
And, yeah, and, you know, I keep it regularly updated, so there's always stuff to see there. And also, you can get there, there's the free digital preview comic for Geek Girl One. So if you want to check out a decent-sized preview of it first, you can get that at the Facebook group.
Very good, very good. Now, of course, I got to ask, what are your other projects doing? You've got other things, Cabercini, Almighty's, all these other things that you're, of course, working on all at the same time. How are those things doing as we get right at this point?
Well, in terms of Carver, because Carver is my other, you know, big four-issue miniseries, big character arc thing. And that was basically, we got to the point where it was done, except there's about four pages which I need a new artist for, because it's going to take place in Carver's mindscape, and it's going to need a different style. Mm. So we got to the point where it's, you know, it's all done. Four-issue miniseries is done, apart from this four or so pages. But with Geek Girl having come out monthly, that needed, you know, my focus and time to promote it. And also, you know, I've done, you know, final tweaks to it as I've, you know, sent each issue off to the printers. So I'm going to be picking things back up with Carbra. Mm-hmm. That will hopefully, the miniseries will hopefully launch this year. I mentioned there's that free Carbercini Dark New Year, which is a good thing to check out, and you've got a kind of crossover universes thing there, because as I say, you've got Mr. Mashup, who's also in Geek Girl. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's, you know, that's in a good place. That'll once issue four is done and the sort of heavy promos are done, I'll be able to focus more on that. And the Almighties has been the third one. We had issue one and we had issue zero, and we've now got the Almighties Afterbirth one, and that's coming on. That's going to be a one shot. I think we're Eleonora, who's the main artist from issues one and zero, is illustrating again. And for those not aware of the Almighties, the website for that is almightiesamass.com, and it's a comedic super team. It's a lot more there are elements of parody. It's a lot more sort of, whereas you're talking about Ruby and the sort of real life connection, this is somewhat more ridiculous. And it's co-created with Mike Gagneau. Mm-hmm. And it comprises two of his characters, Mason, a borderline psycho, Nightfang, a cocky British punk who transforms into a werewolf, and then my characters, Maxitron, Armored Ego, Maniac, Miss F, former downtrodden housewife, turns swinging super heroine, and Stefanos, who's just some guy who runs the takeout, but for some reason is in this team. Mm-hmm. And also bringing in our Deadpool parodying character, Wayne Winston, who is introduced in issue zero, and we'll join the team proper in the new one. And it's coming on good. We've got Eleonora's doing a nice job. It's coming on, so hopefully that will surface this year as well, hopefully.
I remember a while back you were trying to do some kind of petition so you could write Deadpool as a comic. Is that any movement on that, or is that kind of
I actually wrote an article tying into that this weekend, which is up at Bleeding Cool. If you ever look at Bleeding Cool, there's somewhere you'll see an article with the link, because it's got a picture of New Mutants 98. And I've talked about how, yeah, I had this driving force to write Deadpool, and I detail what exactly I did with that in the article. But then as Geek Girl grew and things changed with Deadpool, because the part of the drive, though I still want to write Deadpool, part of my drive was it wasn't the character I knew and loved from the Joe Kelly days. I felt it had lost some of the depth that it had, but then that has come back with initially Brian Posehn and Jerry Duggan writing it, and now Jerry Duggan continuing it, and it's brought back what I loved about the character. So I realized that part of the reason I wanted to write it as much as I did was because it wasn't, you know, Deadpool being one of my favorite characters, I wasn't getting the Deadpool I wanted, and now I am. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I realized that at that time, I hope to write Deadpool one day, but I don't feel I'm high enough profile at this time. And I think when the Carver comes out, the Carver miniseries, which is, you know, there are similarities between her and Deadpool, because she's kind of cracked and crazy and gun toting, but not in a, not in the sort of wackadoodle Bugs Bunny style. But there are similarities, and yeah, when we get to that stage, then you know, possibly I might be in a better position to kind of set up my stall as a would be Deadpool writer.
Well, you've got the character that is a Deadpool alike, so maybe what'll happen is if Marvel takes notice of that, maybe that'd be a good thing, you know, just to kind of point that out to Marvel. Hey, you know, see, I'm already doing something like Deadpool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I have done, as I say, I talk about all the things I've done in regards to sort of getting noticed by Deadpool editors in this article. And, yeah, I mean, Wayne Winston is, in some ways is a conscious thing, because it also kind of shows, look, I can write Deadpool, even though it's now a parody of a parody. It's, you know, it's a somewhat ridiculous version. But, yeah, I'm still, very interested in working on the Merc with a Mouth.
Very good, very good. Well, hope you get the chance. You know, you never know. Things are going to go, because there's a second movie for Deadpool coming. And, you know, the Deadpool Income is doing real well for the first movie, too, R-rated, which is interesting, too, because the Logan movie now is R-rated after the success of Deadpool. So we'll see how that goes. You just never know. But I hope you get the chance to do that sometime.
Yes, thank you.
And, you know, we're looking forward to getting these good things. If you haven't picked up these first three issues, I highly recommend you do that and go to the places that Sam mentioned and get these books. That way you'll be ready when number four comes out, and it's not very far away. So we want to make sure to be ready for that and for future Geek Girl things, which are great fun. So, Sam, you're doing good stuff. Boy, keep it up, and look forward to talking with you when you have more coming out in the future.
Thank you, Ian. I'll be back.
And that's a wrap for this episode. If this weekend is a holiday one for you, have a great time. And even if it isn't, we'll see you next week. So until then, keep reading your comics.